the region. In Yemen, it could help stop the killing tomorrow simply by cutting off arms, spare parts, and help in the maintenance of weapon systems. Such pressure would push the Saudi regime to definitively end its destructive airstrikes and its devastating blockade of that country, while potentially encouraging the launching of good faith negotiations to end the war in Yemen. When it comes to Egypt, the Biden administration has offered more than $6 billion in weaponry so far, including missiles, helicopters, and transport planes. All of that is going to the regime of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who is widely regarded as the most repressive leader in that country's history. The al-Sisi government has gunned down demonstrators in the street, locked up thousands of political prisoners, and run a scorched-earth counterinsurgency campaign in the northern Sinai Desert that has killed innocent civilians and driven thousands of people from their homes. Last April, the U.S. regime offered attack helicopters worth millions to Nigeria, marking the latest stage in the warming of relations between the two countries that began early in the Trump years. That was $997 million. The Nigerian military, however, has committed torture on a massive scale while targeting thousands of civilians in an ongoing campaign against the terrorist group Boko Haram and its local offshoots. As Human Rights Watch has reported, there is a reasonable basis to believe that Nigerian security forces have committed crimes against humanity. Amnesty International reported that 10,000 civilians died between 2011 and 2020 from extreme neglect in prisons run by Nigeria's military. And far from reducing terrorism, such conduct has further destabilized significant parts of the country, stoking opposition to the government and making it easier for terrorist groups to recruit and operate. Earlier this month, the security situation in Nigeria had deteriorated so badly that Biden administration ordered the family members of U.S. diplomats to leave Abuja, the capital, due to a heightened risk of terrorist attack. The website of Truth Out noted, while the humanitarian consequences of U.S. arms sales may be devastating, if you happen to be a major weapons maker like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Raytheon, or General Dynamics, the economic benefits are enormous. Weapon systems built by those four companies alone have figured in more than half of the $100 billion-plus dollars in major arms offers made since President Biden took office. While those firms prefer to pose as passive beneficiaries of carefully considered government policies, they continue to work overtime to loosen restrictions on weapons exports and expand the number of countries eligible for such equipment and training. To that end, those four giant firms alone routinely donate millions of dollars to key members of Congress while employing 300 lobbyists, many of them drawn from the ranks of the Pentagon, Congress, and the National Security Council. Once on board, those retired generals, admirals, and other officials use their government contacts and inside knowledge of the arms sales process to influence government policies and practices. A particularly egregious and visible example of this was Raytheon's effort to pressure Congress and the Trump administration to approve a sale of precision-guided munitions to the Saudis. A former Raytheon lobbyist, Charles Faulkner, worked inside the State Department to keep the Saudi arm pipeline open, despite that country's bombing of civilian targets in Yemen, and then Raytheon's former CEO, Thomas Kennedy, even went so far as to directly lobby Senate Foreign Relations Chairman Senator Rob Menendez over Saudi arms sales. He was rebuffed. But the most spectacular lobbyist for the Saudi was, of course, Trump, who justified continuing arms sales to Riyadh after the regime's 2018 murder of U.S. resident, Saudi journalist, and Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi this way. $110 billion will be spent on the purchase of military equipment from Boeing, Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and many other great U.S. defense contractors. If we foolishly cancel these contracts, Russia and China would be enormous beneficiaries and very happy to acquire all this newfound business. It would be a wonderful gift to them directly from the United States, he said. In fact, neither Russia nor China would be able to replace the U.S. as Saudi Arabia's primary arms supplier anytime soon. The kingdom is so reliant on American equipment that it might take a decade or more for it to rebuild its military around weapons supplied by another nation. In reality, expensive as American arms sales to the Saudi are, that $110 billion figure was a typical case of Trumpian exaggeration. Actual sales during his term were less than one-third of that, and jobs tied to those sales in the U.S. were similarly far less than President Trump claimed. The figure he liked to throw around, 500,000, was at least 12 times the actual one. Still, the damage done by the weaponry his administration rammed through Congress for the Saudis has been incalculable and can't be measured by the dollar value of any particular sale. The Raytheon lobbying campaign was extraordinary primarily because its details became public knowledge, but count on one thing. Similar efforts by other military-industrial corporations surely take place behind closed doors on a regular basis. One precondition for reducing dangerous arms deals would have to be reducing the political power of the major weapons-producing companies. Also, responsible statecraft wrote U.S. military forces have been engaged in unauthorized hostilities in many more countries than the Pentagon has disclosed to Congress, let alone the public, according to a major new report released late last week by New York University School of Law's Brennan Center for Justice. Afghanistan, Iraq, maybe Libya. If you ask the average American where the United States has been at war in the past two decades, you would likely get this short list, according to the report. Secret war, how the U.S. uses partnerships and proxy forces to wage war under the radar. But this list is wrong, off by at least 17 countries in which the United States has engaged in armed conflict through ground forces, proxy forces, or airstrikes. The report's author Catherine Yon Ebright wrote in the introduction, "This proliferation of secret war is a relatively recent phenomenon, and it is undemocratic and very dangerous. The conduct of undisclosed hostilities in unreported countries contravenes our constitutional design. It invites military escalation that is unforeseeable to the public, to Congress, and even to the diplomats charged with managing U.S. foreign relations."
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The skyrocketing energy prices have cost Europe nearly $1 trillion, according to a new report stating that the current situation as the fallout of the war in Ukraine is just the beginning of the deepest crisis in decades. Citing its calculations based on market data, a report published in Bloomberg said $1 trillion is a broad tally of more expensive energy for consumers and companies in European countries. However, that's just the beginning. After this winter, the region will have to refill gas reserves with little to no deliveries from Russia, intensifying competition for tankers of the fuel. Even with more facilities to import liquefied natural gas coming online, the market is expected to remain tight until 2026, when additional production capacity from the US to Qatar becomes available. That means no respite from high prices. The report also referred to more than $700 billion pledged by the European Union governments to protect consumers and companies from soaring prices, noting that aid is becoming increasingly unaffordable as interest rates are rising and economies are already in recession amid the war in Ukraine. Government fiscal capacity is already stretched. About half of European Union member states have debt exceeding the bloc's limit of 60% of gross domestic product. A rush to fill storage last summer, despite near-record prices, has eased the supply squeeze for now, but freezing weather is giving Europe's energy system its first real test this winter. Last week, Germany's network regulator warned that not enough gas is being saved and two of five indicators, including consumption levels, have become critical. With supply tight, businesses and consumers have been asked to reduce usage. According to the International Energy Agency, the EU managed to curb gas demand by 50 billion cubic meters this year. But the region still faces a potential gap of 27 billion cubic meters in 2023. That assumes Russian supplies drop to zero and Chinese LNG imports return to 2021 levels. The main source of pipeline gas from Russia to Western Europe was Nord Stream, which was damaged in an act of sabotage in September. The region is still receiving a small amount of Russian supplies through Ukraine, but heavy shelling of energy infrastructure by the Kremlin puts the route at risk. Without this gas line, refilling storage will be challenging. Also, LNG imports into Europe are at record levels and new floating terminals are opening in Germany to receive the fuel. Government-backed buying has helped Europe attract cargoes away from China. But colder weather in Asia and a potentially strong economic recovery after Beijing eased COVID restrictions could make that more difficult. Chinese gas imports are likely to be 7% higher in 2023 than this year. Beijing has started securing LNG supplies for next year, putting it in direct competition with Europe for spare shipments. China isn't Europe's only problem. Other Asian countries are moving to procure more gas. Japan, the world's top LNG importer this year, is even considering setting up a strategic reserve, with the government also looking to subsidize purchases. For the likes of Germany, which rely on affordable energy to make products from cars to chemicals, high costs mean losing competitiveness to the US and China. That puts pressure on Chancellor Olaf Scholz's administration to maintain support for the economy. The challenge is finding the balance between keeping factories running and homes heated in the near term. The Kremlin has lashed out at a decision by the European Union to put a price cap on natural gas in order to supposedly deprive Russia of funds to continue the war against the neighboring Ukraine. The Kremlin spokesman, Dmitry Peskov, said on Monday that the decision was an attack on market pricing mechanisms. Peskov's criticism came after EU energy ministers agreed to trigger a cap if gas prices exceed 180 euros per megawatt hour for 3 days on the Dutch tidal transfer facility commodity gas hub's front-month contract, which serves as the European benchmark. The price cap can be triggered starting from February 15, 2023. Reuters reported, citing a document detailing the final deal. Three EU officials were cited by Reuters as saying that the Netherlands and Austria abstained from voting on the decision. Both countries had resisted the cap during negotiations, fearing it could disrupt Europe's energy markets and compromise Europe's energy security. The EU officials added, Germany voted to support the deal despite having raised concerns about the policy's impact on Europe's ability to attract gas supplies in price-competitive global markets. The deal followed months of debate on the idea and two previous emergency meetings that failed to clinch an agreement among countries that disagreed on whether a price cap would help or hinder Europe's attempts to contain the energy crisis. Poland, however, welcomed the agreement, saying it would be an end to what it called market manipulation by Russia and Gazprom. Russia's war in Ukraine started in late February, with Moscow saying that it was aimed at defending the pro-Russian population in the eastern Ukrainian regions of Luhansk and Donetsk against persecution by Kyiv. The cap is also aimed at punishing Russia for cutting off most of its gas deliveries to EU countries in reaction to the sanctions that the bloc has slapped on Moscow over the war. An Israeli settler has run over two Palestinian brothers near the city of Nablus in the north of the occupied West Bank, making them the latest victims of Israeli settler crimes. According to Palestinian media, Mohammad Motair and his brother Mohannad had stopped their vehicle by the side of the road near the Zatara military checkpoint south of Nablus to fix a flat tire. It was then that an Israeli settler hit the siblings, who were traveling around with their family members at the time, and fled the scene. The victim's relatives said that 28-year-old Mohammed was killed immediately after being trampled on by the settler, while his brother, 24-year-old Mohannad, was seriously injured in the same accident and was later announced dead due to his injuries. Reacting to the atrocity, Hazem Qasem, a spokesman for the Gaza Strip-based Hamas Palestinian Resistance Movement, said the settlers are escalating their aggression against Palestinians. He added that the formation of the new right-wing government in Israel has apparently emboldened settlers to ratchet up their crimes against Palestinians. He described the incident as a new episode in the series of, quote, Zionist terrorism under the protection of the regime's police and army, saying this crime must be answered by increasing the resistance in the West Bank. Israeli occupation soldiers and settlers have been noticeably escalating their attacks against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank and other areas, in an attempt to forcibly expel Palestinians from their lands and make way for expanding Israeli settlements. Israeli forces have also been conducting overnight raids and killings in the northern occupied West Bank, mainly in the cities of Jenin and Nablus, where new groups of Palestinian resistance fighters have been formed. Since the start of 2022, Israeli troops have killed more than 210 Palestinians, including more than 50 children, in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds, as well as the besieged Gaza Strip. Earlier, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs described 2022 as the deadliest year for Palestinians since 2005, when the UN started to keep a tally of Palestinian fatalities. The world body says Israeli forces have shot dead 19 Palestinians, including three children, in different incidents across the occupied territories between November 22nd and December 11th. In addition to the killings, Israeli forces have blocked the main entrances of several villages across the West Bank, disrupting livelihoods of thousands of Palestinians. Scores numbers of Israeli settlers, guarded by police, have stormed the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds under the pretext of celebrating Hanukkah holiday. Earlier, the Israeli police stormed Al-Aqsa and forcibly expelled Palestinians stationed inside, paving the way for the illegal settlers to storm the compound. Israeli forces deployed heavily inside Al-Quds Old City in preparation for securing the settlers' incursions and preventing Palestinians from entering the mosque. Israeli settlers intend to storm Al-Aqsa for 8 days to celebrate the so-called Hanukkah, also known as Festival of Lights, which extends from December 18th to December 26th, as settler groups promoted the storming by announcing free transportation for its members. Israeli groups and extremist settlers had previously called for massive incursions into the holy site during the Hanukkah holidays. Hardline Israeli officials and settlers regularly stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied city, a provocative move that infuriates Palestinians. Settlers' incursions on Al-Aqsa Mosque frequently trigger clashes that leave casualties among Palestinians. Such acts of violence even led to an 11-day war between Palestinian resistance groups in the besieged Gaza Strip and the Israeli regime in 2021, during which the regime forces killed at least 260 Palestinians, including 66 children. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the latest raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli settlers. Hamas says such incursions are provocative and very dangerous. The movement has urged Palestinians to mobilize immediately in defense of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The resistance movement stressed the Palestinian nation will make sure to protect the mosque under any circumstances, warning Israel of the consequences of raids on the holy site. The Jewish visitation of Al-Aqsa is permitted, but as part of a decades-old agreement between Jordan, the custodian of Islamic and Christian sites in Al-Quds, and Israel in the wake of Israel's occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967, non-Muslim worship at the compound is prohibited.
When it comes to Peru, the country is unraveling quickly. Just last week, Peru's president, Pedro Castillo, was removed from office. His charge, rebellion, which came after he announced that he would shut down Congress and install a government of exception. This occurred just before he was due to face an impeachment vote. Then came his arrest, charged with allegedly breaching constitutional order. But these accusations were not enough. He was also accused of an attempted coup. Enter Castillo's vice president, Dina Boluarte. She also accused the president of a coup attempt. And just a few short hours later, she was sworn in as the new president, becoming the first female head of state in Peru's history. Boluarte called for a political truce and the installation of a national unity government. No surprise that the coup set up mass protests all across Peru. This is while the unelected government ordered a violent crackdown, with police to have killed numerous protesters. Yet things have moved rather too quickly, leading one to conclude that there may be foreign hands at play, in this instance, from the U.S. For example, just 2 days before a coup against its elected President Castillo, the ex-CIA agent and U.S. ambassador to Peru, Lisa Kenna, met with Peru's defense minister. And there are reports that Peru's defense minister, who's a retired brigadier general, ordered the military to turn against Castillo. The U.S. ambassador to Peru, Lisa Kenna, met with Peru's unelected leader, Dina Boluarte, and reiterated Washington's wholehearted support. Kenna, in another post, tweeted, "The U.S. categorically rejects any extra constitutional act by President Castillo to prevent Congress from fulfilling its mandate." This all showed that the U.S. government had staunchly supported Peru's unelected administration. In a statement, the U.S. State Department stated, "The U.S. commends Peru's institutions and authorities for safeguarding democratic stability. Troubled by violent demonstrations and reports of attacks on the press and private property, the U.S. recognizes Dina Boluarte as the country's president."
Thank you.
When Castillo moved to dissolve Congress, he cited Article 134, and he made it clear that it was only going to be a temporary closure. He said new congressional elections would be held as soon as possible. Yet the U.S. ambassador to Peru failed to mention Article 134 of Peru's constitution, which states, "The President of the Republic is authorized to dissolve Congress if it has censured or denied its confidence to two councils of ministers." The dissolution decree contains the call for elections for a new Congress. The U.S. Ambassador Kenna ignored all of this. Instead, she declared, "The U.S. emphatically urges President Castillo to reverse his attempt to close Congress and allow the democratic institutions of Peru to function according to the Constitution." By this, the CIA veteran meant that Castillo should simply allow the anti-democratic Congress to launch a coup against him. The U.S. Embassy in Peru subsequently published an official statement echoing exactly what Kenna had said. This was Washington's green light for Peru's right-wing-dominated Congress to overthrow President Castillo and for the state security services to arrest him without trial. So it's no surprise there have been headlines that read, "The U.S. egged on the coup in Peru." The move by Pedro Castillo to dissolve Congress ahead of a third impeachment motion seems to be the result of a pressure campaign with support from the U.S. But why would the U.S. be interested in a coup in Peru? One motivation behind the U.S. could be in Peru's natural resources. Peru has a wealth of mineral resources like copper, iron, lead, and zinc. Gold and silver are also found extensively. On the other hand, the U.S. has been against the group of left-wing presidents who have taken over in Latin America in what's called the pink tide, with many not leaning so much towards the West's economic and financial system, like from the U.S. After all, they did not reap the rewards that a Western capital system offers, which has turned out to be just a mirage. Brazil's President Lula da Silva has even said that it wants to move away from the dollar and decrease the dependency as much as possible. The CIA has organized many coups against democratically elected left-wing leaders in Latin America, from Guatemala's President Jacobo Arbenz in 1954, to Chile's President Salvador Allende in 1973, not to mention the attempts to remove the former Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez.
Japan is allocating $320 billion in an effort to build up its military, a move that would be unthinkable under previous administrations. But now, under the Liberal Democratic Party led by Prime Minister Fumio Kishida, surveys say the budget has the favor of over 70% of voters. The military developments include extending the range of Japan's missiles, stockpiling of spare parts and other munitions, reinforcing logistics, developing cyber warfare capabilities, and cooperating more with U.S. and other like-minded countries. The extension of the range of Japanese missiles is only meant to be able to reach China, if the need were to ever arise, as there is no other reason to extend the range to around 1,000 kilometers. The reason why Japan feels the need to advance its missile technology is the escalation of tensions in the Indo-Pacific region. North Korea has, on multiple occasions, tested intercontinental ballistic missiles capable of carrying nuclear warheads, one of which landed a little too close for comfort to Japan. The China-Taiwan tensions are also cause for concern for Japan, as a potential military escalation could put Japan in danger as well. This is because of the large number of troops and massive amounts of supplies that the U.S. has stationed in Japan, which they would most likely take advantage of in case of an escalation with Taiwan. Here's what Prime Minister Kishida said with regards to the military build-up plan.
"We can feel a rapid increase in the severity of the security environment around our country. In countries and the regions surrounding our country, a strengthening of nuclear and missile capabilities, a rapid military build-up, and attempts to unilaterally change the status quo through power are becoming more pronounced."
Kishida also emphasized on the issue of China as a challenge to its security. He said, "China's current external stance and military trends are a challenge to our country's peace and security, the securing of global peace and stability, and the enhancement of international order based on the rule of law." To which Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Wang Wenbin responded by saying, "Japan disregards the facts, deviates from the common understandings between China and Japan, and its commitment to bilateral relations, and discredits China." Japan even believes that Russia is a threat to its security, albeit indirectly. Tokyo sees Russia's war in Ukraine as a dangerous precedent that might encourage China to carry out a similar operation in Taiwan and cause unimaginable disruption to world trade. By taking stances against North Korea, China, and Russia, Japan must look to the US and South Korea as its allies. $320 billion. Once the budget is injected into Japan's military, it will bump up Japan's ranking among the top military spenders in the world from 8th place all the way up to 3rd place, just below the US and China, even higher than Russia during a time of war. And this amount of expenditure is going to hurt Japanese economy. Kishida's plans will double Japan's defense outlays to about 2% of the country's gross domestic product over the next 5 years. It would also mean that Japan's defense ministry will now have 10% of the country's entire annual public spending. In the document that outlines the plan for the military expenditures, what is not included is how the money will come about. It's unclear whether the government will have to raise money through tax increases or whether it will borrow the money. But if we look at the reason behind this unprecedented amount of spending on military by Japan, that is known for its pacifist constitution, we will realize that if not for the US's recent provocative actions, Japan would not deem its security threatened. North Korea's ICBM missile tests only came about as a result of US provocations, and the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has mentioned this on multiple occasions. With regards to the issue of Taiwan, if not for the meddling of the US in Taiwan's affairs and the breaking of the One China policy that the US had previously agreed to, China would not have conducted the biggest military exercise in its history. If not for the constant eastward expansion of NATO, spearheaded by the US, the war in Ukraine would also not have happened, and Japan's concerns over Russia encouraging China to also attack Taiwan would never come to be. It's almost as if Japan's alliance with the US is costing them more money than it's bringing in. And that is completely disregarding the security risks that this alliance has brought upon the land of the rising sun.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Europe got hit by roughly $1 trillion from surging energy costs in the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and the deepest crisis in decades is only getting started. After this winter, the region will have to refill gas reserves with little to no deliveries from Russia, intensifying competition for tankers of the fuel. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The website of RT wrote, EU member states have spent roughly $1 trillion in the face of the bloc's worst energy crisis in decades, Bloomberg is reporting, citing calculations based on market data. Soaring energy prices have sent its economies plunging into recession as most member states opted to stop importing gas from Russia, facing the necessity to turn to more expensive supplies. The agency highlighted that the total estimated losses marks just the beginning of a full-scale crisis, as a period of high prices for energy could last years, while aid is already becoming unaffordable. The security of energy supply is expected to remain an issue beyond next winter, after the filled gas storage facilities across the region are emptied. The nations of the EU will have to refill their gas reserves for the next cold season with no deliveries from Russia, which also heats up competition for tankers. Even with more import terminals for liquefied natural gas LNG coming online, the crisis will reportedly loosen its grip only in 2026, when additional production capacity from the US or Qatar becomes available. At the same time, prices should remain high to attract LNG away from other buyers, from energy-hungry Asian buyers. A state of emergency could linger for years, according to Brussels-based think tank Bruegel, as quoted by Bloomberg. Once you add everything up, bailout subsidies, it is a ridiculously large amount of money, Martin Devenish, a director at consultancy SRM, told the agency, adding it's going to be a lot harder for governments to manage this crisis next year. A rush to fill storage during summer, despite all-time high prices, has softened the supply squeeze so far. However, freezing weather is expected to give the region's energy system the real test this winter. Last month, Germany's energy regulator, the Federal Network Agency, warned that German households and small businesses have failed their first gas-saving test. The regulator noted that a reduction in consumption of at least 20% was required to avoid a gas shortage in the coming months. Meanwhile, Guardian reported the UK is falling far behind EU countries in its performance and policies on home insulation and energy efficiency, and will lose further ground if retained laws from the European Union are scrapped. According to a new study, the report by UK pressure group Another Europe is Possible and Germany's respected Friedrich Ebert Foundation says the UK is failing to match new EU laws, which aim to double the annual rate of building renovation and reduce primary energy consumption by 39% by 2030. It says that with UK household electricity prices about 30% higher than its neighbouring EU countries, the UK has a lack of ambition to match such targets, despite the price pressures. An additional threat is posed, it goes on, by the UK government's plan to take thousands of EU laws of the statute book by the end of next year, which will further widen parts of this country. The report's author, David Baldock, senior fellow at the Institute for European Environmental Policy, said, "Our sky-high energy prices mean that we have a clear interest in getting the most out of what we use. But the UK government's energy efficiency and home insulation agenda continues to lack ambition. This is said to be a key area of UK-EU divergence in the years ahead, as the EU commits its member states to bold targets on efficiency and insulation. Divergence is a two-way street. It can mean getting rid of existing EU rules we have inherited from membership, but it can also mean not keeping up with changes the EU is making now. We see both of these happening in UK-EU environmental regulation. Devolution adds another level of complexity because, in different ways, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland are all likely to stay closer to EU status quo. Overall, it's a mixed picture with elements of divergence going alongside the expensive duplication of existing EU arrangements without much substantive change. But if the retained EU law bill is not substantially amended, it could see thousands of EU-derived laws taken out of the UK statute book by the end of next year, risking chaos and potentially radical deregulation. A Department of Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy spokesperson said improving the energy efficiency of homes is important to tackling fuel poverty and reducing emissions. And that's why we have committed £6.6 billion this Parliament and a further £6 billion to 2028 to make buildings more energy efficient. The Energy Company Obligation Scheme alone has delivered improvements to around 2.4 million homes, and just last month we launched our £1 billion Eco Plus scheme to accelerate these efforts, installing measures in households who have previously not been able to access eco support, he said. Recently, the department unveiled a new energy efficiency campaign to help people reduce usage and bills.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Role of Erdogan powers policies and recent bitter events in Iran is obvious. This is the part of speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. This ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Officer and Police Training. The US is against a strong Iran and against an independent Iran. They like the Iran of the Pahlavi era, a milking cow that is submissive to their orders. They want a king in Iran who, for a simple decision, would have to ask the English ambassador or the US ambassador what to do. How could the Iranian nation tolerate such a disgrace? This is what they are after. They are against Iran. So these are the aggressors. Control is in the hands of those behind the scenes. Therefore, the issue is not about the issue of hijab. It is not about the death of a young girl. That is not what this is about. Many Iranian women who do not observe the hijab perfectly are among the steadfast supporters of the Islamic Republic. You can see them attend religious ceremonies and events supporting the revolution. That is not what this is about. It is about Islamic Iran's independence, resistance, strength, and power. That is what this is about.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
will say one or two more things to end this talk. The people who are creating corruption and damaging the streets are not all the same. Some of them are young people who take to the streets due to the influence of a program on the internet. They are energetic and emotional. Their emotions cause them to come out. Even so, all of them together are a very small fraction compared to the Iranian nation and compared to the faithful, devoted youth of Islamic Iran. So among these people, there are some who take to the streets because of emotions and excitement. That is an issue that can be fixed with a small punishment. That is, they can be awakened and shown where they're wrong. However, some of them are not like this. Some of them are the remainders of those who were struck down by the Islamic Republic, such as the MKO terrorists, the separatists, the remnants of the sinister Pahlavi regime, and the families of the loathed members of the SAVAK.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the limelight.
U.S. authorities have claimed the war in Ukraine will continue for as long as they want and they will provide military assistance to Ukraine. But many experts are saying America's arsenals of weapons and munitions are running low. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Website of Foreign Policy writes, as the conflict in Ukraine shows little sign of abating, Kiev's Western partners are grappling with how to maintain a supply of arms and ammunition to Ukraine without letting their stockpiles dwindle to the point that it could jeopardize their own readiness levels. A NATO official who spoke on condition of anonymity said, "I think everyone is now sufficiently worried," adding, "The Allies had called on Western defense contractors to ramp up production in the wake of the conflict in Ukraine. The relevance of stockpiling is back." The official said NATO is now discussing how to support member states if their stockpiles fall below the levels needed to meet their war obligations under the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. Although decisions around military aid to Ukraine fall to individual members of the alliance, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has repeatedly spoken about the need for continued armed delivery to Ukraine. Jeb Nadana, a former U.S. Supply Assistant Secretary of Defense for Industrial Policy during the Trump administration, said, "Even if there wasn't the Ukrainian fight, our stockpiles are still too low. You don't have to invent the weapons of the 22nd century to do this, but the industry will need a stable demand signal." Behind the scenes, the United States and other NATO countries have urged Western defense companies to bump up production. However, current and former officials and analysts said defense contractors have been slow to respond as they wait for assurances that the era of an increased arms appetite is here to stay. Mark Kansian, who served as chief of Pentagon's Force Structure and Investment Division until 2015, said, "What they say is essentially show me the money. Their fear is that the war will end and the orders will end and they will end up with these expanded factories that don't have any orders to fill them. Contributing to bottlenecks in production are rising prices of critical raw materials and a shortage of skilled labor." In mainland Europe, where military aid to Ukraine is being dwarfed by the United States and some countries, such as Germany, are still reluctant to dust off old tanks to send to Ukraine. Leaders do not want a mobilization that would put the defense industry back on a seemingly war footing. And skilled workers, high school trained technicians, designers, and safety and environmental experts are often reluctant to bring their talents to the defense industry, fearing that they could be first on the chopping block in any downturn. In an all-out artillery war with the Russians that has lasted almost since the Kremlin declared its operation in the Donbas region in April, Ukraine has practically run itself out of Soviet standard artillery, which comprises about 60% of their arsenal, forcing Kiev to rely more heavily on NATO standard artillery that can't be produced fast enough to sustain the fight. CNN has also covered the same story. Concern is growing in the U.S. government about its ability to keep supplying Ukraine with state-of-the-art systems and ammunition amid its ongoing conflict with Russia. According to three U.S. officials interviewed by CNN, some of the challenges the U.S. is facing in terms of supporting Ukraine include its dwindling stockpiles of arms and the ability of the defense industry to cope with demand. One official told CNN that there is a finite amount of excess stock that Washington can send to Kiev. The report says Washington is particularly concerned about the available stockpiles of 155mm artillery shells and Stinger air defense missiles. Some officials are also worried about the production of arms such as HARMS anti-radiation missiles, GMLRS surface-to-surface missiles, and Javelin anti-tank systems. However, CNN's source maintains that the dent in the stockpiles does not compromise national security, given that the weapons for Ukraine do not come from the supplies the Pentagon reserves for its own contingencies. A senior official also told CNN that the assessment that the United States is running low on arms is subjective, as it depends on how much risk the Pentagon is prepared to accept. Officials say one of the major concerns is that the U.S. defense industry is struggling to keep up with demand, while European countries cannot fully backfill their own stockpiles to replace the military hardware already sent to Ukraine. Since the start of Russia's special operation in Ukraine in last February, the United States and its Western allies have been providing Kiev with billions of dollars in security assistance, with Moscow repeatedly warning that the weapons shipments to Kiev would only prolong the conflict. According to the Pentagon, As of early November, Washington has committed to sending Kiev over 1,400 Stinger missiles, 8,500 Javelin missiles, 142 155mm howitzers, and up to 903,155mm artillery rounds. The website Politico has also covered the same story. A much-touted European Union fund meant to help countries replace weapons shipped to Ukraine is increasingly unable to cover an influx of reimbursement requests, and it hasn't even sent out its first payment yet. Days after Russia's special operation began, the European Union set up a 500 million euro pot encouraging countries to arm Kiev and asked the European Union to foot the bill. According to estimates shared by three diplomats, after looking at the receipts that it has received, Brussels determined it could cover about 85% of the costs. Then the European Union authorized an even bigger pot, eventually totaling 1.5 billion euros. The estimates showed the European Union got so many requests that it calculated Brussels could only cover roughly 46% of the requests. According to the diplomats, the plummeting percentage angered Poland, one of the EU's largest weapons donors to Ukraine, and a leading reimbursement seeker, having submitted 1.8 billion euros in receipts. For days, the country blocked a final agreement on disbursing the second tranche of money, hoping to negotiate a higher rate. One diplomat noted, for them, below 50% is just too little. But according to diplomats, Warsaw ultimately relented, agreeing recently to the 46% figure. The move came as frustration mounted among other member countries of the European Union, who saw Poland as standing between them and large EU payments. Still, the waning payback scheme risks damaging the EU's reputation as a reliable military partner, just as Ukraine implores Europe for more weapons for the conflict with Russia. Already, European Union powers, Germany and France, are facing criticism for not donating enough weaponry and ammunition, while some smaller countries say they're running low on supplies.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Japan has slowly developed the scope and scale of its military forces since its defeat in World War II, despite its pacifist constitution. Prime Minister Fumio Kishida Friday announced a major shift in its post-war self-defense principle.
When considering strengthening our defense capabilities this time, we will assume various situations and consider whether the current capabilities of self-defense forces can deter threats to Japan based on the capabilities of our opponents and new ways of fighting.
Outside the Japanese embassy in Seoul, South Korea, activists protested against Japan's new military plans. Japan ruled over Korea for much of the first half of the 20th century. Civic leaders argue Japan's force buildup, to include various U.S. missiles and counter-strike strategy, can enable its military to again become offensive in nature.
The Japanese government's so-called counterattack capability actually involves preemptively striking enemy bases in North Korea, China, and Russia with missiles. As a result, Japan's principle of self-defense is completely broken, and the peace constitution, its minimum responsibility as a war criminal state, remained empty.
Japan suggests it's responding to increasing threats from North Korea and China. Over the next 5 years, Japan plans to double its military spending from 1% to 2% of GDP. And much of that more than $300 billion is earmarked to be spent in America's military-industrial complex. Japan's new military budget comes just as the U.S. increases its annual